Hello, and welcome to the Resilient Life Podcast. Resilient Life is part of peakprosperity.com. It's where we focus on practical and actionable knowledge for building a better future. I'm your host, Adam Taggart, and today's guest is someone the Peak Prosperity audience knows well, Charles Hugh Smith. In addition to being proprietor of the excellent weblog of2minds.com and a regular contributor to Peak Prosperity, Charles is a prolific author. I've asked him to join me today to discuss his latest book, just released a few days ago, titled The Nearly Free University. The cost of higher education has skyrocketed in recent decades. The average cost of tuition is up over 1,000% since the 1980s, far outstripping price inflation and most other goods and services. Yet despite the accelerating cost, the value of a college degree has been diminishing, both in the terms of quality of education received, as well as future employment prospects. In his new book, Charles takes a critical look at the state of education in the developed world and claims it is ripe for disruption. There are new models and new enabling technologies that promise to deliver more effective learning at much lower cost, but they challenge a very entrenched establishment, meaning that the system will likely fight these innovations. Charles, this is a fascinating and important topic that has direct bearing on our future prosperity as a society. Thank you for joining us today to share your insights from your recent work and helping us make sense of the opportunities and challenges here.
Thank you, Adam. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start at the beginning. Where did our current education system go astray? And what sparked you to write this book now?
I think that the education system went astray in becoming disconnected from the economy. And here's how I would describe the backstory of that. The current higher education system of colleges and universities arose in the World War II era as a centralized kind of command economy outgrowth of the war effort. In other words, the United States increased war production in an incredible degree, and it needed a level of science and technology that was new. In other words, you know, the atomic bomb and just the level of production and just a huge number of people with some sort of science and technology backgrounds were needed to win the war. And in the post-war era, then that all that brain power in technology and science was applied to not just the military, but to consumer goods and computers and so on. And so that model worked extremely well in this sort of industrial golden age of the 1950s and early 1960s. But the model started to go astray when the economy started changing in the 70s and 80s, while the old factory model of education continued on and accreting costs and overhead. That's how I would describe the sort of backstory to where we went astray with this model of education.
Okay. And so what about the situation has risen things to the point where you felt the need to publish this book?
Adam, I think that the system has reached diminishing returns is how I would describe it, that it's just become so obvious that the current system, which I call a factory model in the sense that you take a standard course of material and you give it to hundreds or thousands of people in a sort of factory model, you know, like here's 50 people come in, hear the lecture, they read the same textbook, they take the same test, they move on, another 50 people take their place. I mean, it's very much an assembly line approach to education. And that, as the costs have skyrocketed, the effectiveness of what we're learning in that sort of assembly line educational model, it's no longer paying dividends in the real economy. I mean, statistically, half of all recent college graduates have either no job at all or they're severely underemployed. So this speaks to an enormous disconnect from the higher education system and the economy that it's supposed to be serving.
It's raising a lot of questions for me. But first, let's zero in on the cost aspect. On Peak Prosperity, both Chris and I have been pretty vocal about our estimation of the increasingly poor ROI, or return on investment, that a college degree offers the average student these days, given the high costs, as you've mentioned here, and in the declining returns on the education that's being provided. And I believe there's data out there that suggests that you know, we're actually not graduating students that are as well informed as we have in the past. So, I mean, in some ways, the quality of the education is suspect as well. But you've got these high and rising costs, you've got these deteriorating standards, you've got these weak job markets that you've mentioned earlier on. You've also got an increasing cost of living, you know, much of which we talk about here on Peak Prosperity, is that you know, basic living costs are going to get more expensive as time goes on. And we've also talked, you and I, a lot recently about the fact that interest rates looks like they're back on a secular rise. It really does seem to me that we are graduating a generation of debt slaves at this point in time. That you know, if you take out, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in student loans, it's not that uncommon to get close to $100,000 in student loans these days. And you are fortunate enough to get a job, and you make the average income, and you do all the things that that people do, like buy a house and get married and start a family and all that stuff. You know, a lot of these folks, you know, today's current graduates are going to be paying off their student loans for undergrad, you know, until the time their own children go to college at this rate. How bad is it? I know you're a lot closer to these numbers than I am. I mean, have we really gotten to that point where we are creating a generation of debt slaves here?
I think so, Adam. The numbers are something like this. Credit card debt for the entire United States is something like $760 billion. Auto loans are roughly the same thing, $700 billion or so on. And then we have a student loan debt of over $1 trillion. And what's really astonishing is that the federal government has taken over issuing, not just guaranteeing, but they own these loans. And I'm looking right now at a St. Louis Federal Reserve chart, which shows that the federal government's ownership of student loans went from 100 million in 2009 to 550 million today. In other words, it has skyrocketed as the federal government has basically taken over about $500 billion in student debt. They're issuing it and demanding it, and demanding payment on it. And so you have to ask, how is it that the federal government is issuing $500 billion in new student debt or taking over old debt within a few years? And what is the payoff for our society of saddling college students with $1 trillion in debt? And on the other side of, like, the payoff, in other words, the return on investment, as you mentioned, a huge study, one of the few that actually has tracked the results of a college education, like how much did people learn in getting a four-year degree. It's called Academically Adrift, and it found roughly a third of all college graduates had no increase in critical thinking skills. And another third had marginal improvements in the kinds of skills that we would consider critical in the, what I call, the emerging economy, the parts of the economy that are actually growing and expanding instead of shriveling and fading.
Wow. Well, that really is sobering. And so help me understand two things. The first is, I have heard, and I can't actually say if I know for certain if this is accurate or not, so I look for you to clarify here for me, but I have heard that student loans or education loans are one of the very few forms of debt that cannot be dismissed in bankruptcy. Is that true?
In general, it's true. When I've repeated that online, I've had some people come back to me with a sort of outlier arguments where there have been a few law students who've gone through like seven different courts and seven appeals and gone to enormous expense and trouble, and they have managed to get out from underneath it. But in terms of an average person pursuing getting out from that via bankruptcy, no, it's not possible.
Okay.
And so you have to jump through an awful lot of hoops that are beyond the average person, unless you happen to be an unemployed attorney.
Or an attorney with really deep pockets who for some reason took out loans and wants to go and fight this fight. But unless you're that person, you're basically stuck with having to pay these loans back for the rest of your life until they're paid off. True?
Yeah, I think that's at the current point in time, I think that's relatively true. And, you know, what people can do, of course, is simply default, in other words, stop paying, but then there's a lot of negative consequences to that. I think the important point here, and maybe this is the primary motivation for me writing the book, was this is really unjust. I mean, there's a sense of wrongness to this whole scheme in which students are being told you must have a four-year college degree to get a steady, good-paying job. But it's a cartel system in which there's only a few places that you can get a degree that's useful. And so you're going to have to pay through the nose to get that. And so it's going to cost you $100,000 or $150,000, and you can cobble together some cash and grants and so on and so forth, but ultimately you're going to be in debt for that. And then when you get that degree, and even one in biology or computer science or something that you were told was going to get you a reliable, steady, good job, it turns out to be false because you didn't really learn anything that employers want and need. And so then you have to go through this whole process of learning what you really need to get a job. And that's after you've graduated from college.
Right, and that's usually doing so at very low pay because you're sort of being trained up in those early positions.
Yeah, and so I guess my motivation for writing the book was to question what kind of system would we have if we could start from scratch in terms of higher education. And I think that given the advances in digital technology, I think the answer is really clear. We would take a curriculum based on what's called MOOCs, like massively open online courses, where the very best lecturers are, you know, recorded, and then their lectures are made available for free, and then combine that with what I call YouTube University, where people have posted a tremendous number, thousands of little lessons on academic and practical bits alike. The core idea in YouTube University is if you want to solve a particular kind of equation, then you can go and find a lesson that's like 3 or 4 minutes long that shows you how to solve that one equation. And this, it turns out that there's academic studies on how people learn, and this constant kind of feedback where you take one lesson, you solve it yourself, and you move on is actually leads to more learning than sitting and watching like a 60-minute lecture.
Mm-hmm.
So the point here is that the innovations that actually increase learning are available digitally now for basically free. And so why should an education that's available for free cost $100,000?
Great. Well, let's jump right into this then. I do want to return to the cabal topic before we finish up here today, because there's a couple of additional questions I have there for you, but this really is the meat of what I wanted to talk to you about. So let's really talk about these new models that are, you know, that are either being made possible by new technologies or just by new thinking. You know, I love your concept there about just saying, look, what if we just kind of start from scratch? If we could really just design an education system today without, you know, the constraints of the prior system, how would we build it? So I'd love to hear more from you in terms of, you know, what you see as the most notable models that are out there. You already mentioned the MOOCs and some of these new sort of progressive ways of learning, like the YouTube University you just talked about. You've also mentioned to me in conversations about this mentality or this model shift of accrediting an institution that you graduate from with a piece of paper that says you went to this institution, and therefore all sorts of assumptions about your level of education should be conferred on you, and shifting that to an accreditation of the individual, where the individual has a certain number of, you know, academic awards or you know, certificates of proficiency or whatever it is, and that really becomes the model, where it's really sort of student centric versus institution centric. So please, you've spent, you know, a year writing this book. Enlighten us about what are the things we should be paying attention to right now.
Well, Adam, I think the one you just mentioned is key, and I call it accredit the student, not the school. And the basic idea is in a profession such as architecture or law, in most states at least, just getting a degree doesn't mean that you can go out and practice, because it's understood that you may not have learned enough, or not learned the right stuff, or not have the grasp of the material needed to actually go practice your profession. So you have to take a test. And so, and once you pass this test, which is rigorous, then you are stamped architect, attorney, and so on, and you can go practice your trade. So why can't we apply this model to everything? In other words, if you've got a degree in computer science and that it's understood that you should know something about network security, then you would pass a test and it could be done online, you know, with encryption and various things, or it could be proctored by a real person in a classroom and you pay $100 and you go take the test. But you could be tested for the actual working knowledge that you're supposed to have, and if you pass the test, then you're accredited. You earn that degree. And it could work in philosophy as well as computer science or biology. It could work in anything. And so that eliminates this artificial scarcity of credentials. In other words, anybody could study on their own and take the test and be granted the accreditation. And of course, this was standard back in the day of say Abraham Lincoln. That he studied the law on his own, and then he passed whatever hoops and were in place at that time, and became an attorney. So that idea takes away the power of accreditation from an institution which has a self-interest in scarcity and keeping that credential scarce, to a system that would give everybody a college degree if they earned it.
Well, I really like that. So I guess one question is anybody out there moving towards this yet?
There are. We're at the very early stages of this revolution in higher education. And say there are a few experiments here and there. There are established campuses which are establishing huge, digital education departments that are trying to set up systems for giving credit for experience and this kind of thing, which is the first steps toward what I'm suggesting. But there's three other steps which I think are key to this whole model of what I call the nearly free university. Second one is structure learning so that it no longer depends on large physical campuses and costly administration. And, that's part of why people ask, well, why has education gotten so expensive? Well, it used to be that there were four, professors or instructors for each administrative person. And now in many places it's one-to-one, that you have a under-assistant secretary to the assistant dean drawing $150,000 a year, and you've actually got professors being cut or the number of tenured positions being slashed because the budget's absorbed by administration. Well, in the digital world, all this could be automated. Yeah, absolutely, it could all be automated. People sign up for a class, they're given their tests, they pass or fail the test. It's all done digitally, and they're issued their credential, online. It's like there's no need for a costly administration, or in fact, a large campus that requires tens of millions of dollars to maintain. And then the third point is, I think the curriculum needs to be tailored to the real-world emerging economy. And this is where the current system has completely failed, that it's sort of assumed that your bachelor's degree or your master's magically confers the abilities that employers actually want. But I think that's becoming less and less true. And so the fourth point is eliminating the artificial scarcity of admissions and accreditation. We now go through this dance where, smart kids apply to 10 colleges, and of course there's often a several hundred dollar, fee to apply, and then 1 in 10 kids is admitted, and then there's all this whole dance of scarcity, and the way that it's being distributed is via like this elite, where in the nearly free university model, anybody can take a class from MIT or wherever, it's as long as it's digital, and if they master the material, then they're issued a credential. And so there's no scarcity in either admissions or accreditation.
Okay, so that raises obvious questions about how do the existing institutions, how are they reacting to this? I mean, obviously, there's part of it I'm hoping at least excites them in terms of ways to better deliver upon their missions. But I've got to think, especially the way in which this sort of cabal structure has evolved, as you've mentioned. This comes as a real threat, and so I can certainly understand if indeed they're not embracing some of these technologies with open arms. What are you seeing out there?
I think that the large universities are well aware that they need to connect their product, i.e. the education and their diplomas, to some real-world value in the job market. And so there, you see a lot of universities that have like entrepreneurial programs where they try to line up students with entrepreneurial programs or incubators and that kind of thing. So that's one way they're trying to respond is not lowering their cost. They're saying, well, if you come here and give us $150,000, we're going to turn you into a real-life entrepreneur because we have this program that after you've given us $150,000, you get 2 hours with somebody from an incubator. I mean, I know I'm sounding rather harsh, but I think that there's very little evidence that I have been able to find that entrepreneurship is being developed throughout a four-year curriculum. It's sort of being tacked on after you've sat through a bunch of passive lectures on being an entrepreneur.
Yep, yep.
And so I think that the emerging economy is all about having the value system and the skill set of being an entrepreneur, not in having a particular knowledge in computer science or biology or whatever anybody thinks is the key to, the future economy. It's like if you have the skill set to know how to learn and to be an entrepreneur and find value, create value, work with other people to create value, these skills will, you can build a livelihood, irrespective of your degree, frankly. Your initial experience.
Right. Well, that gets us to a question that I was planning to ask a bit later. But, in this new emerging economy you referred to, particularly where you might be able to pick up expertise and skills sort of more organically than going through just sort of an official four-year program, do you really need a degree? Do degrees become less relevant? Does basically just defined mastery in certain areas matter?
That's an excellent question, and part of my response will be that one of the head honchos in Google was interviewed, I think, by the New York Times, and he confessed that they used to seek out, potential employees who'd done well within academia, that they got straight A's or whatever. And he said they did a data crunch on that, and they found that there was no correlation between doing well in academia and being a productive employee of Google. And so in response, they've really diminished their weighting of like academic success. And in fact, he said some divisions in Google, the number of people with no college experience, not just no college degree, no college experience whatsoever, is roughly about 15% of their project workforce. So I think this is indicative of a trend that I call like what people are seeking from you is what you can accomplish and do on your own in the real world, not what stamps you've picked up on your academic passport.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can talk about this from a personal perspective on two fronts. Certainly in my professional experience, I've seen that I went to Brown University for undergrad and went to Stanford for business school. So I've gone to some, fairly well-known and, storied academic institutions. And I have, found firsthand that you can definitely spend a lot of money and go to a top-notch educational institution and still get out of there with very little new learning in your mind to show for it. I like to think I paid attention and got something out of my investment, but certainly not as much as I had personally expected to. And I certainly saw lots of people there who, it was really money down the drain for them. But professionally, I have seen that in most cases, what that piece of paper does, that diploma does for you, is it gets you in the door in terms of the interview process during initial recruiting phase right after graduation. But very, very quickly, I mean, I would say within less than 12 months, it really, in terms of what your employer is looking at, is all about your experience versus your pedigree. And I actually found both in Wall Street and in Silicon Valley, the higher up you progressed inside an organization, you know, some of these large companies I worked for, like Merrill Lynch and Yahoo, et cetera, the higher up you went in the company, the fewer and fewer of the Ivy League degrees you saw, and the more degrees you saw from, you know, really any kind of school, or at least a much more wide variety of schools. And that's because these were the people who had a true passion for what they were doing. They were scrappy, and they just put their nose to the grindstone and did it. So I've certainly observed that myself in my professional career. And secondly, your story about Google makes me smile, because I did recruit with Google a couple of times where they had come and talked to me when I was working both before and during Yahoo. And, not only did they look at my business school experience, but they wanted my transcript, not just from my college, but from my high school. And it just seemed like there was a ridiculous focus there on, you know, what the institutionalized measurements of your academic success were. It really did seem at the time like it was really, you know, a misallocation of focus. And it's interesting and you know, somewhat gratifying to see that they've walked away from that now.
Yeah, based on the data that there is no connection between academic success and being a productive employee. You know, Adam, another thing that sparked me to write the book and to investigate the idea, what would we have if we started from scratch, was the critical role of values in the emerging economy. That in the good old days, the factory model, and I mean both the factory model in education and the factory model of production, that you could get a degree in underwater basket weaving, or in my case, philosophy, and you could then go work for an insurance company or, you know, some white-collar job in which whatever you were supposed to learn, they would teach you on the job. And so your degree literally was sort of like a stamp on a passport. You were not claiming to know anything of value to that business. Well, that kind of world, that worldview and that economy is dying. The idea that you can just show up and an employer is going to lavish a bunch of on-the-job training, that's no longer efficient for the employer. You know, they want somebody that can produce value on day one. And so that's we need to create and teach the value system that's needed in the real economy. And values, of course, are not taught in college at all. You know, it's like this strange magic is supposed to occur that if you finish your degree in biology or computer science, that you will magically sort of know how to collaborate effectively with people, that you'll have an entrepreneurial spirit, that you'll right. understand the mechanics of creating value. And so we don't teach any of these things. And so, well, why do we think people will know them when they exit college, even the finest colleges? And, of course, we have to make a mention here. You're speaking about, you know, the very top 1% of universities. And so what we're really talking about is what's going to happen to the 90% of colleges that are not Ivy League, not huge graduate research, you know, schools like UC Berkeley or University of Illinois, or, you know. So what's going to happen to all those sort of diploma mills? Well, they're going to go away.
No, very true. And you and I have talked about this in relation to the book I wrote on really how to find your authentic career, where very similarly, we talk about that expectation where, you know, even though we never talk about or never teach people about how to identify their own unique strengths, attributes, passions, etc., and map those to professional paths, we have this narrative in our head that somehow by the time you get that degree from a university, that you're going to have it magically all figured out, even though at no point during the, you know, 16 plus years of your formal education, you've ever had a semester that's focused on helping you actually identify what to do with your life. I agree with you, and this goes back to your earlier point about how we're we're really sort of selling a bad bill of goods to the younger generation. With the current model, as we've talked about, we're selling them an increasingly expensive solution that just doesn't work anymore. And, you know, we haven't mentioned other factors that are going on here where industry is becoming increasingly automated. So there's fewer and fewer jobs, especially sort of, you know, entry-level jobs, because those are the jobs that are most easily going to be replaced by a robot or by artificial intelligence. The outsourcing trend is still going on with globalization, so there's increased competition with workers in other countries. Because the economy is doing poorly, and we believe that economic growth, slow economic growth at best, is here to stay, you also have intergenerational competition, where the older, more experienced workers aren't retiring from the system the way that they were. So they're you know, basically blocking new talent from coming in. And you mentioned that basically training and development that's a cost to corporations, and corporations are becoming increasingly focused on profitability and maintaining the bottom line. You know, that's really kind of a perfect storm of really big, powerful forces that are working in opposition to the interests of new graduates. And it's very sad for them, and it's very sad for us as a society when, you know, we aren't, whether it's on the corporate side or the educational side or wherever, providing a pathway for young people to develop skills that have real value and you know, create societal value. We're beginning to see examples in Japan, for sure, for the past generation or two now, it sounds like, and we're seeing it in Europe as well, where we're really breeding these lost generations, and I fear we're doing a similar one here in the States.
Absolutely, and I think we can say that at least in certain parts of Europe, there's too many universities and not enough people that are willing or able to pay for the product. Because once you start doubting that the product is going to help you get a job, then you go, well, why should I, scrape up the money, even in Europe where education is largely subsidized. So I think the other point that I want to make here is that, so how do you get a job in the emerging economy, the part of the economy that's growing, if a college degree is not enough? And my answer is mastery. And that's the other thing that's been lost in our higher education system is that mastery means that you know a subject or a technique and a skill set well enough that you can go out there and create value more or less on day one.
I think that's excellent, Charles. Just as you deepen on this, in your book you talk about distinguishing among work, learning, and mastery, and I'm hoping maybe you can just elaborate a little bit more broadly on all three here.
Yes. Well, I'll try. That I think that the model that is a good touchstone is the old apprentice master model that you find in cultures like Japan and in the East and also in the European tradition, where the young student is taken on by a mentor master who. And they serve a long apprenticeship to really learn the whole trade or the whole business, the nuts and bolts, often spending years doing what we would call grunt work, that you're doing the repetitive part of the business to really master the fundamentals. And then once you've mastered that thing, that trade, that set of knowledge, then you're able to create value. And that, I think, is still a key a way to understand how to create value in the economy, whether it's like traditional, like learning how to weld so that you can go, create value in the real world by welding something that had been broken, or if you're going to be creating digital software that creates value for some business by cutting costs and improving products and whatever your field. If you really understand it and really know it, and you're able to collaborate with other people effectively, like you've learned these skills that and values, then you're going to get a job, or you're going to create your own. And that whole process is not passive. It's not sitting in a classroom, either watching a dull lecturer or watching a MOOC, a massively online course, sitting there passively. You really have to be engaged, and so. For me, I think that there is a need for the workshop model within what I call the Nearly Free University. In other words, it's not just enough to sit there and passively watch lectures and take exams. To master something, you're going to have to be engaged in the process of problem solving, and that usually requires mentoring by a real person. So I don't foresee a future in which everybody's just getting their degree by sitting in front of a computer for 1,600 hours or whatever. It's definitely you have to engage the real economy, and that means learning something to mastery under some mentoring by people who actually work in the real economy.
Mm-hmm. And I know that this isn't necessarily in your book, but it sounds like you're describing a model here where perhaps instead of dropping a lot of money to go sit in a university classroom for 4 years, that you would you would maybe contract with an organization, a company, whatever, or an individual expert, and say, "Look, let me come work with you." It might be for little cost, or maybe no cost. Maybe you're simply paying your living expenses instead of paying tuition, but you're actually there, as an apprentice. You're getting real hands-on work experience, and I would assume you'd probably end up spending less than a university tuition, at least all-in university costs. But even if you were doing the same, it's a model where, at the completion of the process, you have mastery versus a lot of kind of book knowledge in your head. And is that a fair way to sort of characterize at least one of the models that you're alluding to here?
Yes, I think so. And it's not that book learning or sitting through lectures is excluded. That stuff is now free, so anybody can pursue that stuff, and you can acquire as much of that knowledge as you have time and interest in. And so what we're really talking about is everything that you have to learn beyond that passive lecture, book, testing knowledge in order to be productive in the real world and become, an employee or to create your own job. And so that's more along the lines of building social and human capital as opposed to learning a particular knowledge set, which if history is any example, will be obsolete within a few years anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, Charles, I'm so excited about the content of this discussion because it's, as I talked about earlier, it's such an important issue for us to really figure out for the future of our society, but also because so much of what you talk about really resonates with my own personal observations in both the academic and corporate world. I've got two daughters. I think a lot about whether college is, or at least the traditional college path is the right one for them, which I'm sure, if my parents heard me state so publicly, they'd be rolling over their graves if they were dead, but fortunately they're still very much alive. But I know there's a lot of other people that are listening to this who probably have children that are approaching college age. There might even be some listeners to this podcast who are in their teens and thinking about, choices to make in their own education. So for those that are really intrigued by what you've been talking about here today, in addition, of course, to reading your own book, how would you encourage them to learn more about these new models?
That is, that's a tough question, actually, because there's a lot of ferment in this field, but very few programs that issue the kind of accreditation equivalent of a diploma. And so in this sort of juncture where the old system is still holding sway and the new one is developing very quickly, but usually as an outlier, then my suggestion is have two approaches to your livelihood and finding your career and path in life, and go ahead and take classes as cheaply as possible. The community college, the state university, the state universities are adding these MOOC courses as well. Get as many credits as you can, as cheaply as you can, and go ahead and do that and pursue whatever degree you think you need as a passport, to the job interview you want. But also, at the same time, pursue these other avenues of learning, like pursue mastery, pursue social and human capital, pursue having the value system that's necessary in today's economy. you know. And so that's a big workload. That's a big challenge for young people. But I don't really think there's any other way to move forward except to get more or less 2 degrees, the one that you're learning from experience and aiming at mastery, and then the passive standard factory model college diploma that you get for earning 120 credits.
Right, right. And you know, while it maybe sounds, you know, a little discouraging that you're essentially going to have to do double duty here while, you know, society is in this sort of middle ground of transition, trying to figure out where we're headed, you know, certainly investing in opportunities that help you to develop mastery, those are just always going to benefit you down the road. I mean, it's not like that's going to be an investment that you feel didn't pay off for you.
No, it'll probably be the time you spend sitting in classrooms or watching online courses that you question the validity of. But it's certainly possible. I will end on this positive note. Basically, this is what I did. Now, I did it in the 70s, which seems like ancient history. But the college experience is literally unchanged. I mean, I don't think it's much different from 1970 to 1950, frankly. Mm-hmm. The whole academic setup is virtually unchanged for the last 50-plus years. So while I was sitting in classrooms and earning credits, I was also working for a contractor and learning like a half dozen tradecraft skills. So when I got my BA, I also was like a carpenter, painter, concrete finisher, et cetera, et cetera. So, and I did have to work a lot, but so what? You know, it's better than wasting your life playing video games.
Well put. Well, hey, I've got two quick questions for you as we close here. The first, as I mentioned earlier, I did want to briefly return to you to the cabal structure of the current educational model. And one thing I also, this is just another question that I wanted to get your clarification on. I have also heard that, as I understand it, because you know, you mentioned earlier the government is taking on so much of assuming so much of the education debt that's out there, and the debt that the government doesn't assume, I believe it's private lenders that are assuming, that colleges really don't have any exposure to your ability or inability to pay back your college loans, your university loans. And therefore, they actually have a broken economic incentive, or broken is probably the wrong way, but they have a wrong word, but they have an economic incentive that is not in the interest of the student, basically to increase fees up to the point at which the market will bear. Is that true?
I think it's absolutely true, and that's the mechanism by which tuition has gone up 1,000% since 1980. And you know, people complain about health care. Well, health care only went up 600% in that time frame, and that's adjusted for inflation, by the way. That's on top of inflation. So you could never have these kind of enormous increases in expenses in tuition and fees if there was not basically a spigot of endless money that someone could borrow in order to pay your fees. And so you're absolutely right. The schools have no incentive to disband or the student loan system. They will all die on the vine if that system implodes, but we already know it will implode because the kind of trajectory of growth of student loans is unsustainable, and so something is going to break in the system. Either the defaults will rise above the current 13%, or the government will have to, declare a debt holiday. But you're right, the schools have no incentive to question the student loan system. In terms of the cartel or the cabal system, it just boils down to controlling the accreditation, the issuance of diplomas. And once, as long as you control that and limit that, then you can create like what we call a scarcity value, you know, that you can charge a lot of money because there's only a few slots that you've arranged to be open. Whereas in the nearly free university model, anybody can attend the school in the sense of study the material and take the course, and so anybody can earn the degree or the diploma as well. So there's no scarcity value left. once your credit's a student instead of the institution.
Right, and I think, you know, a big part of the appeal of those new models is the incentives seem much more aligned with the interests of the students. And that's why I wanted to bring all this up, which is if you are a parent and you're thinking about what path to help your child decide to go down, it's just we want to make sure you're making an eyes wide open decision with all the facts about how the game is currently structured. And when you take into account the misalignment of incentives that we've just talked about here, as well as something that Charles mentioned earlier, which is that colleges are not really, there's no metric that colleges are held to that measures the success of their graduates. You know, most of their metrics are, you know, matriculation rates, graduation rates, things like that. There's no easy way to say, well, graduates from this school make 60% more than the graduates of this school, or 60% more satisfied with their lives, or 60% more fulfilled by their jobs. And so, as Charles says, you know, they're controlling this accreditation branding, if you will, and it's a perceived value that I personally think, and certainly Charles has helped me continue to feel even more so this way, that it's a false value, or it's an overinflated value. And so when you're looking at the exceptional cost of education, at least traditional education nowadays, and the benefits that students get in return, there are some very high risks now. And we've talked a lot about the economic risks, you know, where students can end up, really being debt serfs, or at the very least, wasting a number of years of their lives and feeling that they don't really have many new marketable knowledge or skills as a result of their time through education. So I'm just making sure that, or underscoring the fact that increasingly we really need to weigh all the models out there, the old and the new, so that as we send our children off into their futures, we are not saddling them. We are instead putting wind at their backs. So with that, Charles, thank you so much for your time. My last question for you is, where is your new book available?
It's available on Amazon.com as a digital ebook, a Kindle ebook that's you can open on any digital device once you download the free Kindle reader, or as a print book via Amazon.
Fantastic. Well, we'll have a prominent link to that book that accompanies this podcast. Charles, I want to thank you again for another wonderful interview, but particularly for the time and the energy that you've put into shedding a lot of light, not just in the problem definition, but really much more so on the potential solution set of this really critical topic.
Thank you very much, Adam.
All right, Charles, and talk with you soon. Thank you.
Okay.